Hello, listeners, and welcome to CMI's Peace Talks. I'm your host, Antti Ämmälä, CMI's Communications Manager. In this show, we look at the world through the lenses of peacemaking. We have conversations with both our own and other top experts on what it takes to build lasting peace in this unstable world situation. In the wise words of our founder, Nobel Peace Laureate Martti Ahtisaari, we believe that all conflicts can be resolved. This podcast is about how to do it. The coronavirus crisis is speeding up the emergence of a new world order that shakes the very foundations of global peace and security. A global power shift is in the making as tensions between the United States and China are rising by the day. And vaccine nationalism could become the latest symbol of declining international cooperation. At the same time, rapid technological change gives new tools to advance and fuel conflicts. It is clear that the practice of peace mediation needs to adapt to this new reality if it wants to stay relevant in the future. This episode of CMI's Peace Talks is done in collaboration with the Changing Character of War Center of the University of Oxford and the Geneva Center for Security Policy. My guests today are Annette Idler, Director of Studies at the Changing Character of War Program at the University of Oxford, and Jean-Marc Riquely, Head of Global Risk and Resilience at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, and CMI's Program Director, Ville Brummer. It's a pleasure to have you all here.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
So, dear guests, to set the scene, what is your analysis of current key trends affecting the field of peace mediation? Annette, would you like to start?
Most of the world's lethal conflicts are multi-party conflicts with quickly shifting alliances among and between actors. And this, of course, has several implications for peace mediation and peace building more generally. What we see in cases of multi-party conflicts where one or a few armed actors demobilize, but the other ones remain present, is not the disappearance of the conflict, but often simply a reshuffling with new forms of what I call non-state order emerging. And that often includes splinter groups, it includes militias that may not have political objectives and therefore are much harder to engage in peace talks than a large, hierarchically organized group, for example. So let me just give you three examples from my own work on this. First one is Colombia. The Colombian government and FARC, the rebel group, they signed a peace deal in 2016. 2017, the FARC demobilized. And when I visited local border communities close to the demobilization camps shortly afterwards to understand how they experienced and perceived this change, they were actually not happy at all. After the FARC had left, many other armed actors tried to fill the power vacuum. And from the locals' perspective, this was even more worrisome than the situation before. Another example is, second one is Myanmar, where I also carried out fieldwork earlier this year. If you look at the national ceasefire agreement in 2015 there, it was signed by some, but not by all groups, not all signatories adhere to it. Again, this puts local communities in very tough positions because it's not always clear which armed actor imposes the rules of the game, so to speak, and for how long. And peacebuilding efforts face similar issues. And then perhaps the most powerful example is Syria, where the Carter Center at some point counted, I think, up to 7,000 different groups, or at least those who wanted to be seen as groups, with many of them engaging in quickly shifting alliances with each other. And again, if you don't know who is on whose side and for how long, how can you effectively mediate? Now, this is, of course, not new as such, but the number of actors is increasing and the way in which they interact as well. And this is what makes them so hard to address now. And that is then related to the other trends that Hannah mentioned as well, the transnationality of conflict and the use of technologies. Through the development of new communication technologies, for example, the speed at which information has become available, often instantly via social media, has made conflict dynamics much more volatile. It has meant that armed groups can now recruit via Twitter or YouTube, for example, and also that incidents far away can trigger events very close by. So the international community often lags behind with their responses because of this dynamism. And I guess, yeah, we need to get better at anticipating that change rather than reacting to it.
So a highly complex situation in many of today's conflicts. Jean-Marc, how do you see this?
Right. So now I concur with what has been said. Indeed, there is a change in norms, a change in the character of conflict in the sense that there is an increasing number of actors that are on the ground, and also the role of technology. I would add to this that we are currently probably witnessing an inflection point in the polarity of the international system. We inherited from the end of the Cold War of a system that was characterized by the hegemony of the United States. And with 9/11, with the US commitment in Iraq and Afghanistan, the power of the United States has been heavily challenged. And at the same time, we've seen the rise of China. And what we're currently witness is, with the current US administration, is the US retreating from international affairs, China becoming much more active. So this unipolar system is shifting towards maybe a duopoly or maybe a multipolar system. And in that kind of system, that creates uncertainties and that increases conflict. But it's not just the polarity that is changing. It's also, as was mentioned earlier, the type of factors that are involved in this. And it is no longer the case that we only have state actors waging war. We are witnessing groups and sometimes individuals that could have impact on conflict. So there is a democratization of violence. And this leads to a change in the character of warfare, where states might be less interested to be politically exposed to conflict and increasingly relying on surrogates. And this is the thesis we put forward with my co-writer Andreas Kriegs from King's College in a book we published last year about surrogate warfare. And we argue that warfare in the 21st century is increasingly waged by states and non-state actors using either or both human or technological surrogates. And this is also a key development, that technology, with a development in emerging technology, especially artificial intelligence, that will allow increasing autonomy in a weapon system, will develop characteristics of true technological surrogate. That means that technology will be able to have an independent role in a conflict. And that is something that is very different from what we had during the Cold War. So it's the Cold War, we knew proxy warfare, but most of the time it was states that were delegating power to armed state groups on the ground. And now this delegation of authority of violence has actually gone to a new level, where it can be delegated to single individual, to technological surrogates, but also non-state actors could use surrogates.
Mm. So, Will, is it fair to say that the COVID-19 crisis is aggravating some of these key trends that Annette and Jean-Marc are mentioning here? What would you say?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I would say that the period of last 6 months have been certainly an experiment on what happens when people are more isolated inside their countries and between the countries, and what's the effect to the global system. In general, I think that what comes to the COVID-19, I think that at the end of the day, it haven't created so much new trends, but I think that it has strengthened the several trends, especially on the national tendencies, and also the expanded tools and the issues which different parties can use in the war. Just reflecting on what Annette and Jean-Marc was saying, I fully agree. There's more and more actors and more shady connections between the different actors. And I think that this is the the big trend that we see, that the connectivity, both implicit, explicit, known and unknown connectivity between the different actors, I think that that's increasing. And it's not only between the so-called conflict parties, but similarly, it's between the different actors in the international community. And I think that that's the challenge that, that we are facing. So at the end of the day, it's very difficult to define on who are the actually actors in the conflicts and war, and who are the actors in supporting the peace process. If these are not same actors, they are at least closely linked actors. And of course, I think that the one element as well is that both countries and actors in the conflict zones, as well as in the international community, because of the connectivity, I think that the agendas of the different actors are more and more driven by the internal politics. So it's increasingly difficult to analyze any actor and think on what's their foreign policy, what's their foreign policy priorities. But it's more and more driven by the internal dynamics. Mm. And not only in a balanced way, but many times the leaders are speaking only to their own constituencies. Of course, this has been a long-term development, but for example, many people say that now in the US, you cannot find a bipartisan foreign policy, but many analysts analyze the US foreign policy based on the internal developments rather than US strategic interest in globally. So that's how I would say additional component that would I would add to the what Jean-Marc and Annette was saying. And that's the piece which at the end of the day changes not only the character of war, but the character of peacemaking as well.
Mm. I think it's quite telling that the United Nations was established exactly 75 years ago to maintain peace in the world, but now seems powerless in the face of many, many conflicts. So currently, several UN-led peace processes are facing difficulties because deadlock in the UN Security Council prevents an effective mandate. So, and this is largely due to rising tensions between great powers. The question is, what does an effective peace mediation mandate look like in this current geopolitical climate? Annette, what is your view on this?
Well, I think what's very important right now, because of the deadlock that you mentioned, is that we need to understand what was mentioned before about the new type of actors that are relevant. And that refers not only to the conflict actors or the ones that are engaging in violence, but also the ones that are there to solve issues and to mediate. So I think there's a need really to embrace new actors. That relates to regional organizations, it relates to independent organizations, including like CMI, for example. Yeah. But I also feel that it's very important to also think through what can be done at the local level and how. And I would like to just link that back to the current situation of COVID-19. I mean, the UN is not completely powerless. We've seen the global call for ceasefire as an appeal to make humanitarian access possible. The UN Secretary General started the call in April. We know there was lots of delay, of course, until the UN Security Council came to that conclusion as well in July. But we also know that by May, 16 armed groups unilaterally declared ceasefires. That included Colombia, the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. So even though it was delayed, and yes, that doesn't mean that it stayed like that for a long time. In many of these places, we are back to fighting. There is still some force there. On the other hand, there are actors at the local level that can be effective when the UN is not. And I think this is crucial, again, right now in this moment where actually inequalities have been reinforced, I would argue, through the pandemic. I mean, we know that in many places where it's essential to keep on going, where it's essential to implement peace building initiatives and mediation, these are the ones that are now even more abandoned because of lockdown measures, because of simply the stopping of operations. So there is an opportunity as well to really show that, at least at the local level, through other organizations, through NGOs, regional organizations, that the momentum keeps on going.
Jean-Marc, how do you see this in the absence of well-functioning Security Council? What does an effective peace mediation mandate might look like?
Yes, I concur with Annette in a sense that the UN can be perceived as powerlessness on the ground. I think that the role of the UN has always been to be a norm setter. And even though the global ceasefire first to implement it has not yet been implemented, but it creates an environment where still the norms is out there. So at a normative level, the UN has a key function. Now, at the more operational level, the situation is much more complicated because it used to be conflicts. I mean, you were engaged in a war and the objective was to clear, to hold the territory and to build and rebuild. But with the dynamics that we see, you know, especially when it comes to surrogate warfare, what we see is that that type of practice of warfare is really good for delegating power or violence to groups or on the ground to disrupt and to protract. And so if you look at, I'd say, the epitome of surrogate warfare these days is Libya. Or you could also look at the similar patterns in Syria or in Yemen. The number of actors that are being involved in this conflict is enormous. They are constantly shifting alliances. And what is more important is that they are also used by some external actor to deny the strategic objective of the opponents. And so it's no longer about rebuilding, but it's about disrupting. And so in this condition, coming up with mediation is very difficult. And also an additional factor is that these groups on the ground, most of them have no interest in regaining a situation pre-crisis, because most of them are benefiting a lot from chaos. Because first of all, there is some power grabs on territories. But also then they use this local domination, if you want, for conducting illegal activities like human trafficking, for instance. And that is a very clear example in Libya. And so they have vested interests in maintaining a chaotic situation because they are gaining a lot of they're benefiting a lot from this situation. So mediating a situation like this to say, well, we will return, we'll try to mediate to return to a more stable situation is actually directly antagonizing the interest. So this is far from a simple situation, and disruption is the key. When actors go on the ground to disrupt the situation, well, there is not much you can do.
Ville, how do you see this question of effective mandates?
I think that's in the optimal situation. At the end of the day, I think that UN the Security Council should have much more objectivity what comes to the conflict. So, who are the real actors and what can be done about the situation? But I think that in the multilateral setting, I think that there's other elements as well, like the interests of the different countries. And as I said, not only the foreign policy interest, but the internal politics as well. And then I think the third component, which is there always, is the question of the multilateral system. So whatever is decided, I think that that creates a route for the future of the multilateralism as well. So I think that the challenge is that when building resolution, they are not only based on the conflict and the situation at hand, but there's always totally other elements as well, which may hinder the building of the resolution and at the end of the day giving an effective mandate to the special envoys and different institutions. So I fully agree that the objective, there's a lot of challenges on analyzing the situation, understanding a situation, but in the multilateral system, there are even more challenges. And I think that the other point is that UN, as it has been built for 70 years ago, I think that the governments, both the heads of states and envoys and ambassadors of different countries, I think that back then they had a very different ability to shape their own behavior of their own country. But now many countries have been coming much more democratic. Many countries have been building a very good system of good governance. And at the end of the day, this means also that the single heads of state or single ambassador have quite a little influence on what the country as such can be doing. So they can promise very, very little what comes to the delivering of the decisions. Mm. I think that maybe one example of this is the JCPOA agreement, especially the challenges that the European countries are facing. And what comes to the implementation of the JCPOA and especially the economic front of that, I think that it's not about the willingness of the European countries to implement JCPOA, but it's the fact economy relies on independent companies. And because of the good governance, companies have to make their risk assessment, not only based on the guidance of their country, but based on their own assessment globally. And at the end of the day, that prevents, in this case, for example, European companies to do businesses with Iran. At the end of the day, the countries who are represented in the multilateral system, those representatives have less power to influence on the situation than they had, for example, 50 years ago.
So, Ville, maybe an additional question to you with regards to organizations such as CMI who don't operate on this official mandate. What is the added value of independent peace mediation organizations that we can have in these times of strained international relations?
I think there's a two sides of the coin. I think that the one element which is there and has been always there, I think that the organization like CMI, I think that those are the places where the knowledge is accumulated from the different peace process over the time. So I think that at the end of the day, it is a hub for the expertise on mediation. And on the other hand, organizations like CMI, I think they are much more agile, much more flexible. And at the end of the day, at least in CMI, we try to focus on our activities on those places and those cases where international community, for reason or another, cannot engage effectively. But maybe organization like CMI who can have a more objectivity what comes to the conflict analysis and engagement with different actors. That's the space where CMI like organizations are needed. But finally, I think that it's not so clear. CMI was established 20 years ago, and back then it was very clear that there were at least two points that organization like CMI have an added value. One is giving a channels between the international community and the countries who are maybe isolated from that system. And on the other, engaging the non-state actors. But if you're looking at, for example, what the US have done within the last 4 years, they have had two high-level summits with President Trump and Kim Jong-un. They have negotiated agreement directly with Taliban. And also what comes to the relationship with Sudan, I think that there have been a lot of improvements. So where CMI-like organizations are needed, I think that the question is much more nuanced than just say that it's for isolated countries or non-state actors.
Mm. So at the core, international cooperation is about finding common solutions to common challenges, such as conflicts. As we are now witnessing the decline of this multilateralism, the question is how to make things better. Small states are traditionally strong proponents of international cooperation. What capacities and future role do small states such as Switzerland and Finland have in supporting international cooperation? Jean-Marc, what is your view on this?
Right, yeah, it used to be that a small state, especially neutral and non-aligned states, during the Cold War, especially Switzerland, Sweden, Finland, Austria, were playing a key role in mediation, because back then the norms of peacekeeping was that, you know, great power could not provide troops, and there was a need for independent and impartial states to negotiate mandates. We've seen that with the end of the Cold War, this has changed. You have great power that have taken an increasing role in mediation and also in peacekeeping, and the market, the mediation has also become a market. You know, countries and cities are competing for attracting international institution, as well as being a hub for negotiation of international peace deal or agreement. And so that makes the role for small states a bit more difficult. I still think that these countries can play a very important role, because they don't have the same interest and power than other states. So they are always perceived as more impartial. This is still the case for, you know, Finland or Switzerland. As a matter of fact, last week, Switzerland hosted the negotiation between the two Yemeni parties in Switzerland. Then an agreement was reached on releasing prisoners. So this role is still there. But with increasing competition, I think these states also need to be innovative in the way they pursue mediation, especially in the light of development in technology, where if the states wants to keep their niche or their advantage in the field, they also have to develop, probably to use more, to rely more on technology. And we could think of creating, you know, these states creating some kind of a brand, like, you know, Geneva is well known for global governance. In Geneva, we call that International Geneva. And Geneva could, if you want, detach this this label from its geographical location to become a brand, you know, to promote the Geneva international spirit, which is one of trying to convey different actors around the table, multilateralism. So for this, especially if you see that the world is becoming more conflict-driven, there is much more competing center of powers, there will be in the future increasingly a need for impartial actors. And these small states could actually play a role. But then you still have to remain realistic that in the at the end of the day, power politics is still a very important characteristic of international relations, and there are so much they can do. But similar as what the UN is doing in setting norms, being a normative power, these states can contribute to also strengthen this international norm of mediation and multilateralism and inclusivity.
Mm. Ville, how do you see the role of Finland from this perspective?
Well, I would say that it's a question of what's the added value of a small, well-functioning states. But because I think that it's not only small state that makes a good mediator, but I think that there have to be other elements as well in place to effectively support the peace process. But at the end of the day, I fully agree with Jean-Marc on what he was saying. And small states, by definition, I think that they have an interest much more on the rules-based multilateral system and stability of global stability, because we don't have any tools, other tools to protect our countries. So I think that this is the well-known objective for the small states, which I think that then is reflected in the conflict zones as well, in a way that everyone understands that there's no additional agenda in addition to those fundamental elements, which make then easier for engaging with difficult discussions. So I think that that's a one. Looking at the future and especially there was some mentioning of evolution of a bipolar world order or tensions between the US and China. I think that we have to acknowledge that there's a third sphere as well, the rest of the world, which my understanding, most of the countries see not benefit of choosing either or, but most of the countries would want to have a certain level of independence and sovereignty on trading on the both sides, maybe having a military alliance on one side, being able to use the develop technology that can be sold everywhere. And I think that in this case also, small countries have an interesting position because they have to connect to all the spheres. Mm. And they actually create a layer where there's a huge amount of connectivity to the different bonds at the different layer. And hopefully that positioning can be used in mediation and peace processes as well in the future. Mm-hmm.
So Annette, would you like to wrap up this part of discussion on international cooperation? What needs to be done to revive international cooperation, and what factors will shape multilateralism in the future?
Well, I fully agree with my colleagues, with Jean-Marc and Will, about the change in which multilateralism is taking shape. And I mean, what we've discussed about the world moving from a bipolar to perhaps a multipolar world is important. But I would actually argue that it's more than that, and it's more than the rest of the world. We also have moved into a multi-conceptual world, even where different people have very different kind of views of how the future world should look like. I mean, there is no longer the shared vision of what is good for the world. Some argue that this is related to the decline of the liberal world order, for example. And so it's not just about where is power located, but also what are these visions of what is actually good for the world, what we should have in the future. So I think to reinvigorate the international cooperation as a first step is that we really need to acknowledge and respect these different views, first of all, and then see how we can find common ground in what should be achieved for the future. And an example there is, I mean, this goes back again to the UN system, but the Sustainable Development Agenda, for example, that includes SDG 16 on peaceful and inclusive societies. So there are certain elements where we see common ground, and they might be minimal, but again, this is a starting point to then see what, how can we take this forward, and how can we respect other views of what is good for the world. Another, again, another example is the agreement on the global call for ceasefire that we mentioned before, that of course is a norm setter. So I think what's important is, first of all, find this common ground beyond different concepts, beyond different views of how the world should look like. But then, of course, also we need to move beyond the just state-bound thinking and be more creative in terms of how other players come in. And that includes not just states, because again, we go back to states, but it also includes NGOs, cities, and I would also add to that the private sector, large companies that can come in as creative players that we can use as an opportunity.
So cooperation at different levels between different actors is needed. So if we then move to technological advancements, a second key trend affecting the field of peace mediation, it seems clear that the use of new technologies, as mentioned, such as publicly available drones or social media to fuel and advance conflict is growing. And the use of these new technologies blurs the lines between war and peace. Jean-Marc, you're an expert in modern warfare. How do you see this?
Yeah, this is very much a trend that that we witness, and what we see is a democratization of technology, access to technology, and that means proliferation. What we are witnessing in the last 20, 30 years is the increasing digitalization of the world. And on this digitalization, some technology are being built, like artificial intelligence. And so once you have developed a product or a specific technology, which might take some time, but you release the product in the digital domain, then it's almost impossible to prevent its proliferation. And so what we start to see now, and we had example already in the past, for instance, if you look at social media, the first group that understood the power of social media, how to use social media as a force multiplier, was ISIS, the Islamic State. They basically relied on a American doctrine of the 90s, which is shock and awe, using ultra violence by filming decapitation or execution, and then using the virality of social media to have an impact. And what we've seen is that they were very successful, at least at the beginning. So technology has become a very important dimension in escalating conflict, in getting message across. And what we see currently is the role of information. And I concur with Annette when she said that we need to adopt a much more holistic perspective on mediation. We need to adopt a multi-stakeholders approach. And in this approach, big multinational companies in the tech sector have to have a say. If you think about Facebook, for instance, and the role that Facebook has played in displaying information in with the Rohingyas, for instance, if you don't have in your mediation effort the company like Facebook, it's almost impossible to be successful. So what we see now with social media is that people get stuck into the information bubble, because we all rely, we all have psychological biases, and people tend to digest or adopt the information that concur with the existing belief and disregard information that contradict the beliefs. And that creates bubbles where communities are no longer talking to each other. This is one first trend that we see where identities, values are becoming much more important. And what we see is that these different communities are no longer talking to each other. So an important role for mediation is trying to build bridges between these communities. Now it comes to more weaponization, if you want, the kinetic aspect of and the impact of technology on the kinetic aspect. Yes, you mentioned drone. Again, if you look at ISIS, ISIS bought off-the-shelf drones, replaced the small cameras that these drones were equipped with small pods containing hand grenades. And during the Battle of Mosul in 2017, up to 30 Iraqi soldiers were losing life on a weekly basis with attack conducted by ISIS using tactical weaponized drone. This is the first time the non-state actors has gained a tactical air superiority over traditional actors. So here again, we see a modification of the dynamics of conflict where non-state actors can now rely on off-the-shelf technology, repurpose this technology, and have a strategic impact. And so an important aspect that we have to deal with now and in the future is trying to come up with governance framework for these emerging technologies so that we can prevent the malicious uses of this technology. Don't get me wrong, technology is not bad. That's not my point.
Mm. So, Annette, are we seeing a future where peacemakers and peace mediators cooperate with big tech companies like Facebook mentioned here? Well, how do you see the future?
Well, I think, yeah, I agree with what Jo Mark said about the way in which technology shapes those conflict dynamics. I think what I would add to that is really the role of technology, in particular, the shift from the carbon-based economy to a post-carbon world as well. Mm. Because it's not just that conflict dynamics on the ground are shaped by those technologies, by as the methods. It actually also relates to the places where we see conflict, the locations, because it's driven by the need for resources to produce those new technologies. So natural resources, including, rare earth elements such as cobalt, lithium, graphite, which is necessary to produce batteries and other components of new technologies, they have become in great demand. And what that means is that they challenge the place of oil and gas at the center of the international community's attention, which means there are new vulnerabilities in the international system that we haven't seen before. Today, geopolitical dynamics linked to local or regional conflicts, and of course also external military interventions, they are shaped by the location of strategic resources. And this actually is likely to shift zones of insecurity. Today, we can see, for example, the relevance of oil in the Middle East that informs strategic calculations of international power players. But tomorrow, we might see, for example, graphite in China, cobalt in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or lithium in the shared triangle of Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia. Those areas may actually intensify tensions between states and non-state actors, and as we've discussed before, also among several non-state actors that strive for the control over such territories. So I think this is another dimension of technology that we really need to grasp to see where do we need to focus our efforts in the future. But I would also say that it all brings opportunities, those developments. Mm. I mean, first of all, if we look at the relevance of non-state actors, of more actors, but also of this shift in locations, it draws attention to the fact that we need to better understand local level dynamics, see what's happening on the ground to account for all those different actors present, and to also understand the kind of non-state order that prevails. So just as an example, actually it can often be better for the locals to live under one single group because it gives them what I call my work shadow citizenship. You have a mutually reinforcing relationship between the community and the armed actor who provides services and also actually protection. So that, I mean, we've seen that in cases, even in cases like ISIS, but also in other places in Afghanistan, in Colombia, which might mean that the local population supports those actors rather than in other places where you have many different groups or a state of rivalry, which is what I've addressed in my book, Borderland Battles. So we really need to see what is the view of the local population on those dynamics. Also with regard to the transnationality, the international, the dimensions that we've discussed, I think it signals that we need to move away from a purely state-centric approach that equates conflicts with state territory up until the borderline. That's why, for example, at Oxford, we've developed an approach where we focus on settings of organized violence that can spill across borders, where we have a dynamic unit of analysis, conflict shapes, so it's no longer states as the unit of analysis. And then also on the point of technologies, I mean, we've talked about the negative consequences, the disastrous consequences that new technologies can have, but there's also a lot of exciting work on peace technologies. For example, how the use of social media groups helps communities to stay safe, how it's being used to facilitate the sharing of information. We also know that new technologies help democratize access, give a voice to locals more than before. Of course, there's still certain shortcomings. Not everyone has access to those technologies. Not everyone is able to use it appropriately. But I think that's something that we're moving to. And again, I think there's a lot of potential for peace mediation to make use of these new tools.
So Ville, how do you see the implications of this technological change to peace mediation? What does it mean in practice? How peacemakers need to react to this, and maybe comment on some of the positive sides of things that Annette mentioned here?
I think that one have to look at the positive sides as well. And I think that now the social media certainly have the a real a positive layer as well, what comes, as Annette said, what comes to democratization and so on. And the next element is maybe the question of artificial intelligence and the big data, because now I think that they are mostly used for the companies themselves. So the data is it's owned by the companies, but I think that there will be a point, at least in Europe, where the data is available for all the citizens, and the algorithms crunching the data are available for use of the other citizens. So I think that that will also increase the transparency and democracy in the global system. And I fully agree that we have to work with the Facebook and the companies who have the data and the algorithms. But I think that we should not only work in that model where the data is owned by the companies, but I think that what comes to the peacemaking, we have to take into account that there's an element of a government-owned data and algorithms, and there's an element of a citizen-owned data and algorithms. And somehow combining these three elements, I think that it's a spear where peacemakers who are working at the global level have to balance between. Thanks.
So, dear guests, to sum up our discussion, in your opinion, what is needed from the practice of peacemaking to adapt to this new reality that we have discussed in this episode, if it wants to stay relevant in the post-COVID-19 world? Would you like to start, Jean-Marc?
Yeah, I think what was already mentioned during this this episode, I think that there is a need to broaden the type of factors that are participating in mediation efforts. There is a need to anchor the multinational companies, the private sector, The problem there is that the objectives of these companies are not the same as the NGOs. The rationale are not the same. It's much more, it's obviously commercial. And so there might be conflict of interest. That said, though, there are also new opportunities provided by technology, as was mentioned by both Ville and Annette. And I think, in a way, this business has to reinvent itself by using technology as a, not a force multiplier, but as a mediation multiplier. But you have to bear in mind that this evolution will be done in an environment where there are very much contested concepts of the world. And what Ville said about owning the data and people owning their own data, we see that there is a lot of contention on these ideas of data rights that are not shared by every state in the system. So there is a need for innovative solution, but technology enables also to create movements that are coming up from the bottom up. And so if technology can aggregate these people, then this will have an effect on mediation probing.
Mm-hmm. Annette, you have highlighted the fact that we need more holistic view of mediation. Is this your key message?
It's definitely part of it, yes. I would say there are three main points that are really relevant. The first one is to have this holistic approach is a perception-aware approach that really focuses on people on the ground to better understand why they are acting in certain ways, what I mentioned before about the different concepts, right? But also how they are affected. For example, in the case of shadow citizenship, why they would support certain groups. And that is also related to information management. I mean, we've seen, it was discussed at the beginning, the spread of rumors, of fake news, of information warfare that also adds to conflict dynamics. So that means we really need to think about better education so that people are aware of the potential of rumors and are more careful about fact-checking, for example, on who violates ceasefires agreements, whether a threat pamphlet is real or whether someone calls for violent action. Because ultimately, it doesn't necessarily mean or matter what happens, but actually what are people's perceptions of what happens. And this is what shapes conflict and the possibility for peace. Then the second point related to that also that makes it holistic is a global approach, which means that we need to have an approach that is locally grounded, that I mentioned before, to understand what's happening, but that connects with global development rather than looking at this as a siloed approach where some professionals would only work at the local level and others only at the global. It's really the connection between the two that matters today. And then finally, related to that is that we really need to become more flexible and more agile, including through the use of peace technologies to account for those constantly changing conflict dynamics that really goes into multiple directions. I mean, it includes the actors involved we've discussed, the methods used, the resources that fuel conflict, the environments, the places where conflict takes place, and finally also the impact it has on people. So these three elements, the perception-aware approach, the global approach, and the flexible and agile approach, I think this together leads us to the holistic approach that we really need in peacemaking and peace mediation.
Mm. So Ville, as a final note, what is your view on this, how to adapt to this new reality?
I'll come back a bit on a couple of steps, and while I fully agree on and I have really enjoyed the discussion, I fully agree that the conflicts and the peacemaking system is coming increasingly difficult to understand, complex with the different layers, actors, and so on. I think that at the end of the day, the fundamental principles of peace mediation still holds. So despite that everything is difficult, I think that one needs a willingness to find a solution. And on many fronts, if one wants to advance and negotiate a solution, you need a compromise. So you cannot gain all the things that you want, but you have to do a compromise. And also thirdly, you have to engage with bright people. You have to engage with those actors who have a power to influence the conflict, and you have to engage also with those actors who are part of the broader system, who in the future may shape the system in, I would say, in a positive or negative manner. I think that despite the fact that this is increasingly challenging, extremely difficult, still I would say that the basic principles of mediation still holds, and the willingness to do, willingness to reach a solution and find a compromise, that's still in the heart of our peacemaking.
Dear guests, thank you for this interesting and important discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to CMI's Peace Talks with Antti Ämmälä. If you like our show, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. You can also send us feedback and propose topics to discuss via social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or by sending email to comms@cmi.fi.